viewers. I am Dr. Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky, and with me today is Dr. Andrew Erickson of the Naval War College. Dr. Erickson has recently edited a volume called Chinese Aerospace Power, or is it China's Aerospace Power? Actually, I think I got this wrong in the review.
Chinese Aerospace Power, Evolving Maritime Roles.
Evolving Maritime Roles, which I have a review of it up at my website, and I'll actually post that on the Facebook page. Remember, for you dedicated Foreign Entanglements viewers, we do have a Facebook page. You can go there and you can like it, and it will have a variety of different links and so forth to issues of the day. So how are you doing today, Andrew?
Well, Rob, I'm doing very well, and it's great to be here. I really enjoy this opportunity to talk with you and with your viewers, and I think there are some very exciting issues for us to explore here.
Right, right. This is the first day of spring. Well, it's first day of spring in Kentucky. I think it's the first day of spring everywhere. And it's been 80 degrees here for about 4 days. Have you also had a mild winter up in Rhode Island? Or?
We have indeed. So normally this would be the first day of the nice 6 months of the year in Rhode Island, but as an old New Englander, I must say this has been the mildest winter that I've ever lived through.
Right, that's in fact what a lot of people in Kentucky are saying. And this is that's sort of a naval maritime issue for another day, right? I mean, you know, maybe someday we could talk about the issue, at least, of climate change and maritime affairs, but that's not really a conversation for today. So the conversation for today is the latest book in the series on China's aerospace power. I guess, could you sort of briefly, or not so briefly, sort of introduce the book and its major themes and sort of what regular readers would be getting out of the book?
Absolutely, Rob. Well, thanks for bringing that up. Now, before I begin here, I need to emphasize, I'm sure your readers understand this, but everything I'm about to say here reflects only my personal views and not the policies or estimates of the U.S. Navy or any other organization of the U.S. government. That said, let me give a brief introduction to our latest volume here, Chinese Aerospace Power, Evolving Maritime Roles. This volume is the fifth in our Naval War College China Maritime Studies Institute series. These books are based on the annual conferences that our China Maritime Studies Institute holds. The goal of these conferences is to bring in civilian scholars and military experts alike to exchange research and develop a better understanding of where China is headed, particularly as regards the maritime dimension. We consider the maritime dimension broadly to include, of course, specific naval issues, but also energy security, shipbuilding, naval diplomacy, non-traditional security challenges, and cooperation. And over the years, the volumes, this of course is the fifth volume in the series. Our previous volumes have covered China's future nuclear submarine force, China's energy strategy, and the implications for naval affairs. China goes to sea, looking at the history of maritime transformation in a comparative historical perspective.
And that volume compared Chinese naval growth to such countries as Imperial Germany and so forth, right? Other sort of maritime late bloomers who expanded their navies very rapidly.
Exactly. Land powers that tried to become sea powers in most cases either failed spectacularly and dramatically and destructively, or failed slowly and problematically. But we think China is an exception to that pattern.
Right.
The fourth volume in the series, China, the United States, and 21st Century Sea Power, looking at the way in which the U.S. and China have substantial shared interests in the maritime dimension and how they might cooperate there. As with some other volumes and conferences, that's involved a significant number of Chinese specialists, in this case including a Chinese rear admiral. So we're particularly proud of those efforts. But then coming up to our fifth and latest volume in the series, Chinese Aerospace Power, Evolving Maritime Roles, we realized that while there has been considerable research on China's major efforts in the aviation and space sectors, no major volume had ever linked this progress to China's capabilities in the maritime dimension. And so that's really the key focus of this volume. As you know, we divided it up into a number of subsections to cover critical subtopics, and we were lucky to get some of the premier experts on the subject, both at the Naval War College and around the United States and abroad, to contribute to this. We were also lucky enough to be able to add a few chapters after the conference in areas that we thought were important but had not yet been covered in depth. So we really packed as much information as we could while retaining what we hoped was a relatively coherent theme.
Right, right. And most of these essays were also updated. So the conference was in, if I'm recollecting correctly, December 2008, or was it after
that? No, it's 2008. You're correct. So not only did we bring in the extra chapters, we had to ask our contributors to do a lot of updating and editing and wholesale revision. And then as the editors, we had to do that too. I remember spending hours sitting in Seoul, where I was located for the summer, overlooking the Han River and typing furiously away at my laptop, because one of the key things, as you know, about following Chinese developments of nearly any variety these days is that new things are happening all the time. So just when you think you had recorded the latest development dutifully and things are fully up to date, China achieves something new, and then it's necessary to either revise or in some cases actually go back to the drawing board a bit. So that was really a labor of love for us.
Right. Now, okay, so let's start off with, and there were a couple chapters directly on China's venture into naval aviation, but it's particularly interesting because this is something that really has taken off, so to speak, has become particularly exciting over the course of the last year when China's first aircraft carrier, which is the former, I get very tired of saying the X Varyag, but we don't actually have do we have a new name for it yet?
We don't. And I am guilty of throwing the term X Varyag around the internet and in print as much as anyone, and I apologize for its clunkiness. However, official state sources are now stating that the X Varyag will be commissioned later in 2012. However, until it's commissioned, we really don't have a name. There has been no apparently reliable rumor that's circulated there. For a while, in previous years, there were Chinese sources on the internet referring to it as Shurlong, after the Ming Dynasty admiral who helped incorporate Taiwan under mainland administration as a sub-prefecture of Fujian province starting in 1783, that's certainly an interesting historical touchstone, but for a variety of reasons, I think most experts believe it's highly unlikely that the X Varyag would ever be named that officially. For one thing, the number of ships named for individuals is quite limited in China's navy. For another thing, I think the name Shulong, because of those historical connotations, would be seen as too provocative and too over the top. It would not send the message that the mainland was seeking to send across the strait, particularly in this time of decreasing right. cross-strait tensions. What's more, some historical sources at least claim that following his naval achievements, Admiral Shulong was and his immediate descendants were granted substantial concessions in Taiwan, and were seen to have exploited those in a way that the local populace was not happy with. I can't personally verify that specific history, but mm-hmm. there are a number of reasons why I just don't think it can be called a Shulong at this point. If I had to guess, based on PLA Navy naming traditions, it might be named after a large municipality, the largest of the cities. Tianjin comes to mind, perhaps given its right. proximity to water. Perhaps Chongqing does not have the ring that it did a few months ago. right. It could be also named after a hero from Chinese history. A number of my Chinese colleagues have raised that possibility, although endless debates erupt as to whose name sounds good in Chinese characters and whose legacy has just the right connotation. So bottom line is we'll see, but we may not have to wait too much longer on this particular one.
Well, we can only hope that Chinese aircraft carrier naming conventions will display the same level of consistency as American aircraft carrier naming conventions, because of course ours are quite sensible, what with our John C. Stennis and so forth. Now, a little bit about the X-Varyag, because not all of our viewers are going to be up on this. The X-Varyag is referred to as the X-Varyag because it was formerly a Soviet carrier. It was, I think, the hull was built and the deck was built towards the end of the Soviet era. It is the sister ship of the Admiral Kuznetsov, which is the Russian Navy's only fleet carrier and the one that just recently visited Syria. But it's being completed to, you know, not a radically different design, but a considerably different design. I mean, there are going to be major differences between the two sister ships, as would suggest, ships that are completed a decade and a half apart in different parts of the world. It's going to be a ski jump carrier, which is different than American aircraft carriers, which are catapult and arrestor wire aircraft carriers. And this difference is relevant because ski jump carriers normally employ aircraft that are not as appropriate for strike roles, because they and correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but typically aircraft that are thought of as air superiority aircraft, because this is much lighter, it's much easier for them to get aloft. And so what you're thinking about here is basically an air superiority aircraft carrier rather than a strike carrier of the sort that the U.S. Navy employs. A lot of people are suggesting, and I don't, yeah, I mean, you're not just in the book, but also I think in, you had a recent Naval War College article about, Naval War College Review article about this too. X-Varyag is to some extent a test bed, but it's also going to be an operational warship, right? I mean, it has the potential to be an operational warship.
Yes, absolutely. So you're correct in what you're saying here, Rob, that to some extent X-Varyag's history shapes and limits its capabilities. So it's true that it's the sister Kuznetsov-class sister ship of the former flagship of the Soviet Pacific Fleet. So in a way that sounds very impressive. However, that in many ways was a different era technologically, and the X-Varyag still is not up close to the level of readiness that its Soviet sister ship was. Furthermore, although Varyag was certainly purchased from the Ukraine and had some level of potential in the hull, it was not purchased in a particularly advantageous state. Starting in, as I understand it, it was purchased by a Chinese holding company in 1998. But meanwhile, of course, as you know, there was much upheaval in the Ukraine where the Nikolaev shipyard was based. And moreover, because Turkey controls the Bosphorus and wants to be very careful about maintaining it as a channel for safe shipping, and there were some complications. So it wasn't until 2001 that that Varyag showed up in Dalian. Of course, the story,
and it was really a storied transit too. I mean, a bunch of horrible things happened on the way, like, you know, a Greek sailor died, and so, you know, it broke free. It was an interesting transit.
It was truly dramatic. First of all, it was held up for a year and a half amid Sino-Turkish negotiations that, as I understand it, involved the Chinese government agreeing to some advantageous terms for Turkey. Moreover, transporting such a large ship that, according to some sources, including Chinese state media sources, did not come with engines. Whatever it came with, it couldn't move on its own power, so it had to be towed. And there were multiple severe storms along the way, and cables snapped, and the ship almost went out of control. And it took over a year to make it from when it was finally allowed through the Bosphorus to Dalian, in part because it was not allowed to transit the Suez Canal because it wasn't under its own power, so it had to go all the way around the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. And also, while this was supposedly purchased for casino purposes, once the ship got to Dalian, it notably was not refitted with blackjack tables or anything like that. So,
right.
As we say in our Naval War College Review article, there would be no gambling with that strategic opportunity. And perhaps one day you or others can write about what exactly happened in those negotiations and how quickly gambling fell out of the picture. But moving on to what you were saying about the limitations inherent in the platform. So the most advanced carriers in the world, namely those of the United States, for example, have catapult launch and arrestor wires. And what this all does is maximize the load that an aircraft can take off with. And this is really important in terms of fuel and in terms of weapons. And that gets to what you were talking about regarding whether or not an aircraft, a carrier-based aircraft, can hope to have a strike role, which really requires more fuel and weapons carry, or whether it could only hope to be more of an air superiority fighter, which would not require as much. The problem with having a ski jump, as ex-Varyag does, and not having catapults, is that it really limits what you can launch off the carrier. As my former colleague Chris Weave likes to say, who co-authored a great article on this with our other colleague, Professor Nan Lee, there's no such thing as a free launch. So the things that make it easier to get the aircraft in the air limit what it can limit what it can carry. And not only is it an issue of the payload on the carrier-based fighters, but also it limits severely what sort of reconnaissance and early warning platforms can be carried. And in the case of a ski jump carrier, the answer is really not that much. So at this point, ex-Varyag looks limited to helicopter-based airborne early warning with the Z-8 helicopter, which in turn imposes the helicopter platform's limited range, speed, and altitude, as well as the smaller much smaller size of the radar, which then severely reduces the radar's capability. So in many ways, this is an inherently limited carrier just because it's a ski jump and for a variety of other reasons. In terms of because China's just starting out, it's very hard to put things into practice quickly and master the skills necessary to even make the most of that limited platform.
Right. Now, you could still conceivably use the X-Variant in the service of some sort of limited power projection operation, right? Because it could still provide a degree of reconnaissance. It could still provide air superiority over a task force distant from China's shores, or at least as distant as you would want to send it from China's shores. But it just can't provide the same sort of strike as an American or a French carrier.
Well, it certainly can't provide that same strike, and those other capabilities you mentioned are possible in theory. However, it would require more training and capability, and beyond that, it would render the carrier extremely vulnerable to being struck and taken out of commission. So depending on the scenario, that might be a risk worth running, or it might not be an issue, but on the other hand, it might be a real problem and hence something that China would decide not to risk.
Right, and I think, if I recall correctly, there was another chapter in the book which talked about how far behind the Chinese Navy was in terms of aerial helicopter anti-submarine operations, which would be a major concern if you were to put the Varyag into anywhere where it could possibly be harmed by an advanced submarine, right? It would immediately become the most delicious target for any sort of submarine in the area that had hostile intent.
There are a variety of ways in which it could be targeted, and as you noted, the chapter by Lyle Goldstein, our former director of the China Maritime Studies Institute, and our colleague William Murray, as well as the former Naval War College student, Commander Miguel Martinez, went through a lot of Chinese sources, as did many of our contributors, and demonstrated clearly that Chinese ASW is quite far behind. I've seen you note that as well, so this is well known, but your point is very well taken.
Right. Now, we don't know a ton about the next step for China, right? I mean, what do we know at this point? I mean, I've seen a variety of stuff about domestic construction of the next carrier, right? Is there a general assumption that there is a next carrier under construction? And two, is the expectation that it is going to be a platform similar in structure to the Varyag, right? Going to be another ski jump type carrier? Or are they going to be looking to go in a different direction in this next step when we're talking within the next decade and a half or so?
Well, if you give the next decade and a half, that does give a lot of time for different things to happen. But your question is an excellent one, Rob. There's a lot of rumors floating around on the internet, rumors and speculation, including from some Chinese sources, suggesting that yes, indeed, there is indigenous Chinese construction underway. However, I have not been able to pin down any of that conclusively, and the one or two public statements that have been made by Chinese military figures, such as General Chen Bingde, the Chief of General Staff, are unclear on that point. And I think to some extent, some of the inherent ambiguities of the Chinese language tend to amplify this. As you know, Chinese language often doesn't distinguish between singular and plural, for instance, unless it's made explicit, which it often is not in these circumstances. Now, that's not to say that this isn't already happening, but it raises the question of what constitutes indigenous construction. Surely there are programs underway, but are there indeed components being assembled? At what point does this count as carrier production? So I haven't seen anything completely conclusive. But I think the really interesting part of your question is, what will that first indigenous hull look like, and how long will they wait? They have two major options. One is to take the sort of cautious but potentially less productive route, and essentially first try to make their own version of a Kuznetsov class carrier, ski jump carrier, albeit with some improvements of their own. I mean, when you see China emulate various military aircraft, it's often very clearly based on a certain foreign airframe, but I prefer the term emulate to copy because China does tend indeed to make some of its own sometimes rather significant and potent innovations. The other alternative is perhaps wait a bit longer and then try to go straight to a more capable catapult-based non-ski jump carrier. This, of course, would be desirable for a number of reasons. It would allow the carrier to potentially be far more capable. It would allow them to start training in a much more advanced way that was likely to be relevant for a much longer time. It would perhaps preclude their having to invest excessively in ski jump capable platforms that wouldn't be as relevant in the long run. The problem is that might just be too great a leap for them to make in the short run. Catapults, for example, are extremely difficult to develop and operate effectively. They're very high strung, you could say, and it's a very exotic and complex technology. And the same with arresting gear. It has to be, not only does it have to be developed effectively, it has to be operated and reset and optimized for all kinds of weather and conditions, and depending on the weight and the load of the aircraft and the other specifications, all in a very fast-paced, dangerous environment in which both the aircraft itself, the pilots, and their carrier-based crew are at a considerable degree of risk. So these are not things to be done lightly, even if China would really want to do them. And I think it's a genuine question as to which one of those paths they're going to take. But when we do see what that indigenous hull starts shaping up to be, it will give us a good sense of where their program is headed in the short run.
Right, right. And sort of in terms of countries that have this kind of capability, I mean, the French have a catapult and arrestor aircraft carrier, and they're really the only ones, right? I mean, there's some discussion about what the British carriers are going to look like, but in fact, they're still having that conversation, right?
That's my understanding.
Because it might be too, even with U.S. assistance, it might be too expensive and involved to refurbish the new British carriers for Catabar. Just very briefly, and as a comparison, the Indians are going ski jump, right? The Indians are also buying a former Russian carrier, but they're letting the Russians refurbish it, and then they're building their two own. And so they're going to have something along the lines of three carriers, possibly by the end of the decade, or at least so I've heard. But they're going ski jump, right? Is that correct?
That's my understanding. Now, what's interesting about India is it's a very professional navy with a long maritime tradition and considerable experience with deck aviation, but under certain constraints. India, of course, throughout the Cold War had a close military-industrial procurement alliance with the Soviet Union. That's continued with Russia to some extent. So India's in a position where it's been able to do some things ahead of China, but at the price of being very closely tied to cooperation with Russia, which also serves as a limiting factor. So it will be very interesting to see how the two navies progress in their respective deck aviation trajectories now that China's really serious about pursuing this.
Right, right. And sort of interestingly enough, the carrier that the Indians are buying from Russia is a generation before or generation prior to the carrier that the Chinese purchased from Ukraine. But it all gets very complicated in terms of the modernizations. Let's shift from the question of building aircraft carriers to the question of killing aircraft carriers, because, you know, to the extent that we talk about the Chinese Navy and to the extent we talk about the U.S.-China relationship, this has become a very exciting, interesting question. And you talk about it in the book, you talk about it in other places, and a lot of people are talking about this right now, including the United States Navy. And the issue has to do with the anti-ship ballistic missile and the development of ASBMs and how ASBMs might change the equation between, or change the balance between China and the United States, and China and the United States and Japan in the Western Pacific. So, I mean, could you give sort of just a very brief summary of what an ASBM is and why it's revolutionary, or why, you know, maybe revolutionary is too much, but why it's important and relevant?
Yes, absolutely, Rob. Well, thank you for bringing this up. I certainly think Chinese aircraft carrier development is interesting as an indicator of where China wants its navy to go in the future. However, I frequently feel that Chinese aircraft carrier development has received excessive attention and certainly excessive concern vis-a-vis Chinese missile development. A number of analysts in U.S. Government and security research circles like to say it's not so much that China's building a navy as that China's building an anti-navy, meaning when you think of in the unfortunate event of conflict we all hope would never happen, the biggest threat to foreign navies, such as that of the U.S. from China's forces, is not from China's navy necessarily or alone, but rather from China's wide range of forces that can target naval platforms. And here we really have to bring in China's second artillery, or its strategic rocket forces, if you will. There was a Soviet analog to this to some extent. This force has been in existence since 1966, but in its early years it was really focused on China's nuclear mission after China detonated its first nuclear weapon in 1964. It was in 1991, with the end of the Cold War and the change in the strategic situation and the removal of the Soviet threat, that the Second Artillery, arguably partially in search of an institutional mission, as you yourself have pointed out, went into the conventional realm, set up its first conventional brigade officially by 1993, and now these conventional capabilities have burgeoned to the point where there's, in terms of missile numbers, there's roughly a 7-to-1 ratio of Chinese conventional missiles to Chinese nuclear missiles.
If I can pause just very briefly here for and sort of to make this and to compare this to the American system, right? The United States divided up its the development of ballistic missiles became clear. Ballistic missiles were divided between the three services in the United States in a very different way, with some ballistic missiles, sort of very short-range ballistic missiles, going to the Army, with intercontinental ballistic missiles going to the Air Force, and the Air Force essentially being responsible for nuclear weapons, and then the Navy being responsible for submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And what you had in the United States, especially towards the beginning in the 1950s, you even had considerable resistance in the Air Force to the idea of ballistic missiles, right? Because ballistic missiles threatened the traditional role that bombers had played in World War II and were expected to play in another conflict. But in the Chinese case, not only don't have independent naval and air force organizations, it's all sort of under the rubric of the People's Liberation Army, but then you also have a organization that has taken on the specific mission of operating the ballistic missiles. So it's a completely different way of organizing military forces in China than in the United States.
Absolutely, although inter-service rivalry is known in in both countries, and one can recall at the start of the U.S.-Soviet space race the jockeying between our respective services for control of space programs. But yes, that point is very well taken, and again, we see a combination of events and perhaps the Second Artillery's ability to exploit them, and to do so with the approval of a Chinese leadership that was clearly very concerned about furthering China's interests. So after the end of the Gulf War, which really showed China's military how far behind it was technologically, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which allowed China to refocus to some extent on its contested maritime periphery, we should also add the 1995-1996 Taiwan Strait crisis, where statements by Taiwan's then leader, President Lee Teng-hui, angered mainland Chinese officials, and the situation escalated to the point where China's military launched a series of exercises at about the time of Taiwan's presidential election in March 1996, including the Second Artillery engaging in live short-range ballistic missile firings into waters off either end of Taiwan, the north and south ends of Taiwan, although not over Taiwan. President Clinton dispatched two aircraft carrier battle groups towards Taiwan, not into the Taiwan Strait at that time, but in many American views, that had the effect of deterring China regarding the exercises. Some Chinese forces don't agree with that, but in any case, the PLA finished its exercises, and there were not more of those live missile firings. What I have uncovered in my research on Chinese anti-ship ballistic missile development is that this intervention in Chinese internal affairs, as it was perceived in Beijing, really caused the leadership to offer key military industry centers whatever resources they might need to find a way to prevent that sort of a thing from happening in the future. And indeed, by 1997, we start to see research on anti-ship ballistic missile approaches. By 2000, some more mature technological studies had emerged. By 2004, the Second Artillery had published an official handbook that discussed with some detail how to use ballistic missiles to deter aircraft carriers, or in a worst case, to actually strike and disable them. Going up towards the present, according to Taiwan's military and a variety of other official reports, by late 2010, China had started to deploy anti-ship ballistic missiles in small numbers, whatever that means exactly, while at the same time continuing to develop these. In December 2000.
Now we should pause here for a second. Hitting a aircraft carrier is a big thing, compared to a person, but hitting an aircraft carrier with a ballistic missile, especially an aircraft carrier that's moving fast, is a ridiculously difficult thing to do, right? Because it's not just that you need to have an incredibly accurate missile. It's that you need to have, several layers of reconnaissance. You need to have several different layers of communications and extremely data-heavy communications. You need terminal guidance for the missile. I mean, this is a major technological achievement, that developing and potentially fielding an anti-ship ballistic missile, right? This isn't something. This is a significant technological achievement. This is a major thing.
Absolutely, it is. So this is the DF-21 Dongfeng 21 D, or Delta, anti-ship ballistic missile, is the world's first long-range ballistic missile potentially capable of striking moving sea-based targets from mobile, concealable, land-based platforms. The U.S. and most likely Russia as well have the requisite technology base to also develop such a missile, but because they signed the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which had some wording prohibiting them from developing land-based ballistic and cruise missiles with ranges of 500 to 5,500 kilometers, as long as they're both adherents to that treaty, they can't develop this. So China has moved in, has developed the world's foremost sub-strategic ballistic missile force, and has created this new type of weapon system, what Tai Ming Chung calls architectural innovation. It may not involve innovation at the very highest end, but it involves taking various technologies and putting them together in a new way, a way that no one else is. The one potential exception is Iran, which appears to have developed or is developing a much more rudimentary ballistic missile. They really can't be, I think, put in the same category. However, because Iran in some ways is even more favored by geography in what it's trying to threaten to be able to do, potentially the challenge that missile has to rise to is lower. But to my knowledge, those are the only two existing anti-ship ballistic missile programs in the world that have produced missiles that can do some that can actually perform some version of attacking a target. In the case of China's, you're right that we don't know exactly how it would work under realistic conditions. We haven't seen evidence of a comprehensive over ocean test, but numerous sources suggest that a wide range of component of tests short of such a test have been completed, and it's worth noting that many other, or at least a significant number of other weapon systems that have not been fully tested and declared to have reached full operational capability have gone into battle in recent years, for example, in the case of the U.S. So I would not feel comfortable assuming that this missile does not have some capability. In fact, I don't think that China would have started to deploy a small number if it didn't think that it had enough capability to start trying to create some sort of a deterrent. I do think that China tries to keep developing and improving the missile, and I think that even China can't know under real conditions what the bureaucratic data fusion would look like in practice, and that could potentially be highly problematic.
Right, and I mean, we should emphasize that the ASBM is part of a much larger system of systems of Chinese anti-access capabilities, and it's designed to play a role within that system of anti-access capabilities. And we don't know, you know, if push came to shove, we don't know how all of those would work together. And maybe we can talk about that maybe in a second. But it's not just the ASBM, right? It's the ASBM plus China's submarine fleet plus ship-launched cruise missiles that China has, plus the air-launched cruise missiles that China has, plus the land-launched cruise missiles that China has, right? And so it's a variety of different systems. And so when we and all of these systems, right, do require some integration, and they require to a great extent reliance on or what we would expect to be on the same data and communications network to be able to identify where American vessels are, to be able to track where American vessels are, and so forth. And so we shouldn't think about this as just sort of a singular revolutionary. It's obviously a very important weapon, but it's not sort of a single thing that is transforming the world balance of power, right? It's part of a system of weapons that are sort of broadly built around anti-access capabilities with reference to the United States Navy.
Rob, you're absolutely right, and I'm glad you used the term system of systems. I think increasingly in modern warfare, and of course, fortunately, we don't want warfare to actually have to happen, but even in peacetime, modern deterrence and security competition, we really have to think in terms of systems of systems. That's true in terms of an aircraft carrier. The key to understanding the performance of an aircraft carrier is really understanding the system of systems of air operations that can be conducted off the carrier. Likewise with the anti-ship ballistic missile, the missile itself probably is rather capable in terms of hardware, but how it would actually work in practice in the complex system of systems of the reconnaissance strike complex and C4ISR, yes, that's really another question. And then there's also further, regardless of how well that could all work unopposed, there's the issue of potential countermeasures and ways in which these systems could be defeated. And I don't look into this specifically, but I'm sure that the U.S. military has plenty of countermeasures that could be used in a worst-case scenario in this regard. So when I say that this is a potential game changer, or it's very significant, I'm not saying that it would automatically work. What I'm saying is it has the capability to be able to potentially work and pose a challenge, and if all things come together and something isn't done about it, then the results could be tremendously significant. And the very fact of that is something very new and significant, as you pointed out.
Right. I don't remember whether it was Spencer Ackerman or somebody else, but I'll make the post on the Facebook page. There was a post at Danger Room, I think, yesterday at Wired's Danger Room, talking about sort of many of the electronic countermeasures, and not just but an array of countermeasures that could be employed against a DF-21, from sort of electronic and jamming countermeasures to anti-reconnaissance countermeasures to literally blowing it out of the sky with a Standard missile, which is, you know, obviously something that the U.S. Navy is thinking a lot about. Now, I want to talk about two, before we have about 10 more minutes here. Before we go, I want to talk about two more things. And the first is, in the United States now, the big word is air-sea battle, right? Which is, as I see it, a way of trying to get the Navy and the Air Force, the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force, to work together productively regarding a security response to China's anti-access systems. And this comes sort of on the heels of, you know, a generation-long effort at generating jointness. So making sure that there is minimal friction between the U.S. Services. And this comes, you know, a variety of reasons before that for why that became important in 1986 and so forth. But so anyway, the United States has taken very seriously the idea, and is taking very seriously right now, the idea that its military services need to work together at the highest levels of efficiency, because we know from the past that when they don't, bad things can happen. What do we know anything about the state of jointness in the Chinese military, right? We talked a little bit about the tensions and the inter-service rivalry within the PLA before. But, I mean, you really have three different organizations here who are responsible for this system of systems, and those are the People's Liberation Army Air Force, the People's Liberation Army Navy, and the 2nd Artillery. Do we have any sense that these organizations can work together in a productive and efficient way? I mean, in the volume, there was several discussions of their competition over space assets, their competition over what amounted to bandwidth, and so forth. I mean, how serious is the potential for inter-service rivalry, and what effect might there be of inter-service rivalry in the Chinese military?
Well, as we've discussed before, I think the U.S. military and perhaps all militaries have some issue with inter-service rivalry. I do think in China's case it's more acute, not just because China has further to go to really reach the highest level of network-centric warfare, if you'll allow me to use that term, or the highest level of combat operations in what they would call an informatized situation. But there's also the issue of structure. While things are moving slowly towards individual services having more power and the ground forces becoming another service, it's still a very ground force dominated military, and to some extent that has thwarted jointness by putting an emphasis on ground forces and limiting the extent to which China is truly prepared for what we would call fully joint operations. Not only that, because of China's situation in the Cold War and its previous limitations, China didn't engage in combat with what we would call joint operations. The closest thing to a joint operation was in the 1950s, I think 1956, the small Battle of Yijiangshan, which could be generously called a joint operation. Of course, the PLA is trying to become more proficient, and exercises are constantly emphasized that are designed to increase jointness, and the term jointness is used more and more, but most of the exercises appear from Chinese sources to be more what we would call combined arms operations. Different services show up and do their own thing. They don't interact at that highest level that we're used to. So are they making progress in that area? Absolutely. It'll continue, but that's still a real weakness for them. And when you think about some of the more complex operations that could involve multi-access missile strikes, employment of anti-ship ballistic missiles in conjunction with naval force operations, this does really raise some complex questions of how are they going to coordinate those forces, and how are they going to coordinate the bureaucratic data fusion just to be able to guide the anti-ship ballistic missile, for example, when different forces own different sensors and that sort of thing. While that's difficult, I would draw a distinction between operations in China's near seas, the Yellow Sea, the East China Sea, and the South China Sea, and their immediate approaches. China has a lot of workarounds for those limitations and jointness. To some extent, it can separate platforms by time and space, achieve a kind of deconfliction, achieve some sort of pre-planned approaches for some given scenarios. They're not guaranteed to work as well as they could, but there might be some potency there. What I think this really precludes for the foreseeable future is a high level of Chinese capability far beyond the near seas, far into the Indian Ocean. The fact that China is increasing its presence should in no way be conflated with high-intensity combat capabilities. That's where this inter-service thing is really still a huge problem for them, I think.
Right. And to make some comparison with the United States experience, there's a difference between, in both the Korean and Vietnam Wars, the Navy and the Air Force would achieve a degree of peace between each other and sort of co-productivity by dividing up the airspace, right, and dividing up the airspace often in productive ways. But that's not sort of truly a joint operation, right? That's just a way to work around other sort of inter-service conflicts. And the Chinese may still be at that stage rather than true joint capabilities. Last issue, and this has come up several times in conversation about ASBMs, and this is the escalatory potential that anti-ship ballistic missiles really pose. And the issue here, you know, obviously, in any sort of conflict, it would automatically be an escalation if China started firing live weapons at U.S. aircraft carriers, right? Because, you know, this is a U.S. aircraft carrier. It has 5,000 people on board. And, it, you know, if it sinks, 5,000 Americans are dead, which is more than died in the entire Iraq war. And so it's a major escalation even to fire. But, you know, I think people have correctly observed that no one really has a sense of, even if things came to push to shove in some sort of conventional sense, nobody really has any idea what's going to happen the first time the Chinese launch a flight of ballistic missiles at a U.S. carrier group, right? I mean, that is going to be a very worrisome 15 minutes in sort of world humanity, right? I mean, this is potentially an escalatory step that could lead to additional escalatory steps. I mean, what do you have any sense of?